From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. When do blind golfers, divorce demo derby drivers, Navy SEALs, and pool phenoms join forces for the same event? When the Only a Game staff needs a holiday vacation, that's when. Ahead on Only a Game, some of the year's best stories, including the amazing tale of pool champ Kid Delicious and the very fit Navy SEALs invasion of Boston. Also, cracking up cars with a post-breakup crowd and blind golfers hit shots that seem to have eyes. Stay tuned for the best of Only a Game 2007 edition. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There are few lines of work in which improving your performance leads directly to a decrease in your opportunities and your income. Hustling pool is one such endeavor. Get good enough at it, everybody sees you coming, and nobody wants to play you. Such was one of the problems faced by Danny Basevich, a.k.a. Kid Delicious, the subject of a 2007 book by L. John Wertheim titled Running the Table, The Legend of Kid Delicious, the Last Great American Pool Hustler. I spoke to Messrs. Wertheim and Basevich last November, and for the benefit of our listeners, I asked Danny how he had acquired the nickname Kid Delicious.
In my beginning years of trying to get as good as I can at pool, there was a famous pool room in Manhattan in the Village on 21st and 6th called Chelsea Billiards, and I played this guy named Kid Vicious. He was the top pool player in the city at the time, and I drove into New Jersey with a few of my friends, and long story short, I ended up beating them out of $4,200 in a big-time money match where everyone in this city thought I was going to lose, and when the match was over, they said, Kid Vicious just got his money taken by Kid Delicious.
And no pool player really is at the top of his game until he earns a nickname, I guess.
It seems that way. It seems like you're right. It's kind of funny, but most of the top players in the world all do have a nickname. And I got that nickname when I really wasn't maybe considered like maybe one of the best in the world. I might have been considered a very good player, but I've really earned that nickname just luckily. And everything seems to come together with that Kid Delicious.
Well, when did you first realize, and how did you first realize, that you had an exceptional aptitude for playing pool?
Well, pretty much when I first started to play. I mean, the first day I walked in the pool room when I was about 13 years old, named Elite Billiards, about a bicycle ride away from my home, and I walked in, and immediately I found a great love of the game, and it made me so happy, too, and it was just amazing how much it brightened up my life and how soon I knew I had something special in my hands right away.
John, how did you first learn about Kid Delicious?
Well, the story is I was reading the Wall Street Journal about 3 years ago, and they had a recap of a pool event at Grand Central Station. And just sort of in passing, they had mentioned one of the players in the field. I forget how they phrased it, but it was, you know, a heavy-set hustler from New Jersey named Kid Delicious who made a six-figure income hustling. And then they sort of went on with what happened with the rest of the tournament. I said, you know, I don't particularly care who won this tournament. I want to know more about the Kid Delicious who made six figures hustling.
Danny, at one point you went on the hustling road with a road buddy who goes by the name of Bristol. He calls you the master of the soft hustle. Give us an example of how a soft hustle works.
I guess the main thing would be, I guess, to be able to gamble with a guy and get him to lose his money and enjoy it while you're doing that. Mm. And I'll tell you, most of the time, it might have not even been just hustling at all. It pretty much would just be me being myself. I mean, I would play guys for whatever the money was, whether it was for $10 or for $10,000. And, you know, that whether I won or lost the game, I would be laughing the whole time and smiling and telling jokes. And whoever was watching, I'd be, you know, whether I was losing, I'd be talking to people on the side and, you know, and they'd be telling me stuff. And if the other guy played real well or if there was any kind of a big argument or discussion, I always just let it go real smooth and, you know, never get no arguments. And by the end of the night, I knew for sure I was going to end up with their money.
John, do you have a candidate for Danny's greatest day or night of pool hustling?
Well, I think he'd tell you it was when he took $25,000, $30,000 from the Philadelphia mob. But I like some of the initial stories where he was just trying to get the choreography of the hustle. And one of them was he would go to local campuses in New Jersey and sort of pose as the clumsy, overweight freshman. And he would go and buy a school sweatshirt and splatter some beer, some chocolate cake on his sweatshirt, go down to the pool hall and, you know, buy a Coke with a $100 bill and sort of fumble around at the table, and the guys would get on their cell phones and call their buddies to tell them about the clumsy freshman with, you know, bleeding money who was going to lose it all. And then when the stakes got sufficiently high, he would run the table and hustle these slick college kids.
Well, these are cute stories, Danny, but I think we better hear about the $25,000 to $30,000 that you took from the mob.
Well, it was one of me and Bristol Bob's beginning of our trips. We were just an hour from my home in Manalapan, New Jersey, and Bristol Bob said, hey, let's stop at the Boulevard Billiards over here in Philadelphia off the boulevard. And we walked in that pool room, and sure enough, there was a few dozen railbirds hanging around, a bunch of guys getting in the middle of action, and there happened to be this one big bookie there who was probably like a superstar mafia guy, as you could say. And he was there, and he wanted to bet some of his money on a couple players, and he had himself a whole team of players. And I ended up, throughout the whole night, I played one guy named Dale, say, for several hours, and beat him out of a couple of thousand. And then another 3 or 4 hours later, I played this other guy, Eddie Abraham, who at the time was the best pool player in Philadelphia. And finally, I'm all sweaty and tired, and I think my night is done. And I'm thinking, he's got nobody left for me. I'm winning all his dough. I'm up almost 15 grand, and I'm going to leave. And all of a sudden, the mafia guy says, you got to play one more. And the last guy is a U.S. Open champion, Spanish Mike LeBron, one of the best players who's ever lived, you know, as good as a player as Willie Moscone. Hmm. And there's a certain code in pool, and when you up money on a guy, you can't just leave with his money. If he has another bet to make, you have to give him the opportunity to win his money back. And I would never do anything against the code because I was always an honorable gambler and guy. So we ended up playing that last match with pretty much about all the money I was up. And I killed myself all night long to finally have to play the great Mike LeBron for about 15 grand. And I ended up beating him in a long, drawn-out match where I was losing 5-0. I went in the bathroom. I was practically crying, and I washed my face off, and I looked in the mirror, and something just got me mad and found some strength from within my heart. And I come out that bathroom, and I run 13 games in a row, beating them 13-5 and winning about 30 grand and getting on out of there.
It sounds like you had a Minnesota Fats moment from the hustler. He goes into the bathroom, he comes back, his tie is straight, his shirt is clean, and Paul Newman is finished.
Sure, that's exactly what it was like.
All right, I got to ask you about the flip side, though, because every hustler has nights that he would just as soon forget, as well as the glorious night where he wins $30,000. Is there a particular misadventure or disappointment that taught you, maybe this isn't something I can do all my life?
I've never been beat playing for any kind of money over, say, like $100, but there's been a few other things I've lost a lot of money at in my life, and there have been times where I've won $5,000 or $10,000 and that next morning, I end up at the strip club or at the casino, and all of a sudden, my pockets are empty, and I don't know what happened to all my money.
John, how much opportunity is there now for a great pool player like Kid Delicious to make a living in any way other than hustling?
Hustling, unfortunately, seems to be a real dying art for a variety of reasons, but you know, there's these message boards now. It used to be you'd win money in Washington State and you'd be in Denver by the time anyone heard about it. Now, by the time the sun comes up, everybody's read it on a message board. And professional pools had a very hard time forming a viable league. I mean, I think Danny would like to, now that his hustling days seem to be past him, I mean, I think he'd like to be a professional pool player, but there just isn't you know, poker's obviously gotten big, and you know, virtually every other sport has a league where the top practitioners can go and make a living out of it, and pool just hasn't gotten its act together like that. You know, this is not a golden era for pool players.
You can't really make a living as a hustler anymore. You're too well known, and the hustling opportunities aren't there. And John has said professional pool is not too much of an opportunity. What happens next? I know your parents say at the end of the book, maybe it's time for Danny to get a real job.
Well, my dad sometimes says that because I've made some decent money playing in professional tournaments. I guess decent money for a guy like myself, but like now that I got a girlfriend and she's got a 6-year-old little boy and I'm hoping to have a family of my own, right now I give a lot of lessons actually, which I've been doing really well with them at Empire Billiards in New Jersey and also all over the country. If anyone's interested, they could give me a call. And also I do a lot of exhibitions and bar mitzvahs and stuff like that besides tournaments.
Danny Vasevich, a.k.a. Kid Delicious, join me from NPR's New York studios. Danny, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
I've also been speaking with L. John Wertheim, the author of Running the Table, The Legend of Kid Delicious, the last great American pool hustler. John, it was good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Each year, the Plain English Campaign presents its dreaded Foot and Mouth Award to someone who's hammered the language into gibberish. This year's winner is the former coach of England's soccer team, Steve McLaren, who said of Manchester United's Wayne Rooney, "He is inexperienced, but he's experienced in terms of what he's been through." Coming second was President George W. Bush for this quip, "All I can tell you is that when the governor calls, I answer his phone." Said Plain English Campaign spokesman Ben Beer, "We thought it was a bit obvious to honor Bush, as he comes up with them every day." I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, pitching through the unseen sunshine with wedge and iron. But first, the Navy SEALs landed in Boston last June, though they did not reach their destination by perilous scuba journey beneath the Atlantic Ocean and murky waves of the Charles River. They did arrive in dramatic fashion, whereupon they did many push-ups and encouraged others to do the same. Only a Game's Karen Given was there and had the story.
Outside Boston University's Fitness and Recreation Center, helium balloons and rock music herald a visit by the Navy SEALs, who arrived yesterday with a skydive onto the school's athletic field. Inside, Petty Officer Sean Tufts smiles as he gently barks orders at a group of about 25 athletes who've come to test their skills against the Navy SEALs.
Guys, remember, this is a maximum effort evolution, all right? Try and do your best, all right? You guys already taking a big step by showing up here today. Might as well put out as best you can.
The SEALs like to tout their status as the most physically fit of the military special forces. Their training program is so demanding that traditionally, only 25% of recruits graduate Basic Underwater Demolition School, or BUDS. Once a SEAL receives his trident, he'll spend the rest of his career doing PT, physical training, not just once, but twice a day.
You guys look scared. You guys scared? No? You guys fired up? All right. Well, one, you look scared, and two, you don't sound fired up. You guys fired up?
Yeah!
You guys fired up?
Yeah!
All right, go out there. Max effort, right? Max effort. I don't want to see anybody sandbagging.
Let's go. Get in the water.
The 200 people who answered the radio and print ads to take today's challenge will be asked to do the same PST, or physical screening test, that Navy recruits must pass in order to enter SEAL training. A 500-yard swim in 12 and a half minutes, 42 push-ups in 2 minutes or less, 50 sit-ups in 2 minutes or less, at least 6 pull-ups, and a 1.5-mile run in 11 minutes or less. It all sounds a little scary.
No, there's nothing to be afraid of. You shouldn't be afraid of working out, and that's all we're going to do.
Petty Officer John Murray is a SEAL who's been serving in Afghanistan and Iraq for most of the past 6 or 7 years. So he's certainly not going to be put off by a physical challenge.
It's the short little run, a swim, some push-ups and pull-ups, and that's all. Come on, it's fun. Have a little fun. Get off the couch. Get your lazy butts off the couch. Get down here. And work out a little bit, get in shape.
The swimmers jump in and get started. They're a little nervous at first, limited to only the breaststroke or combat side stroke. But they start to gain confidence as they count off their laps.
Louder!
One!
Although they struggle, most finish in less than 13 minutes. After a short break to change into dry clothes, the group boards a bus to go up the street to the indoor track for push-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups, and the run.
Two more, come on, two more, come on.
There are currently less than 2,500 SEALs, and the Pentagon wants to grow that force by more than 500 in the next 5 years. To that end, the Navy has started recruiting at marathons, triathlons, extreme sports events, and college swimming and wrestling camps. But Cornell Galloway, program advertising manager for Navy Recruiting Command in Tennessee, says today's event isn't part of that effort.
Well, actually, the Navy is really aware of the condition of physical fitness in our schools amongst our youth, and we wanted to kind of give back and make a contribution in that effort. So we wanted to challenge the community and to see how everybody stacked up against their physical condition against the Navy SEALs.
Galloway isn't saying how much the day is costing the Navy, but between renting out facilities at BU, flying in the Leapfrogs, the Navy's skydiving team, and advertising costs, it can't be cheap.
Well, no, but you can't put a value on you know, return of investment out there. We want to make a contribution. No, I don't think money is the issue here today. We'll get back and count beans when we get back into our office in Millington. We're kind of enjoying it. I don't think we have any agendas here today. The real benefit is how they feel about themselves at the end of the competition.
Weston Graham is called a Depper. He's in the Navy's delayed enlistment program and holds a contract to go to SEAL training. Ever since signing up back in November, he's been looking forward to shipping out.
Like, not to sound cheesy, but these are like real-life superheroes, you know, and they're human, too. I actually only did one sport through high school, and that was crew. But I learned discipline and how to deal with physical pain, and I realized that we're just a really tight group. And, you know, I transferred schools, but I realized, you know, I wanted to get that feeling again, and I realized I could find it in the Navy. And honestly, you know, that's what it's like.
Joining the Navy SEALs to get back the camaraderie of a high school rowing team might seem like a stretch, but John Allen Williams, professor of political science at Loyola University Chicago and retired captain in the Naval Reserve, says Weston Graham is likely to find what he's looking for.
Oh, absolutely. What you find in the military is the sort of teamwork that you find in sports, which is another reason they recruit at sporting events. You go to sports teams where you find young people, men and women, who who are used to teamwork, who can take orders and give them, who are used to authority, you know, the coach. And that's a very good thing for the military.
The military doesn't publish total advertising dollars spent on sporting events, but last year the Marines reportedly spent $6.5 million with ESPN. The Navy sponsors the Winter and Summer X Games. The Army stages the All-American Bowl. Then there's the more unusual expenditures, like the Air Force's $150,000 custom-built Orange County chopper and the Army's $100,000 advertising campaign in Paintball magazine. Pete Sepp is with the National Taxpayers Union.
Considering that the armed services often have to struggle to meet recruiting goals, it's vital that every single tax dollar be spent effectively. And unless the armed services are comprehensively tracking the results for the money they've spent, it would make sense to hold off spending any more until they can figure out whether this money is being invested effectively.
It's hard to quantify results from non-direct recruiting events like military flyovers at football games and skydiving demonstrations at air shows. Nobody's handing out pamphlets extolling the virtues of military service at the Trident Challenge. And the only recruiting comes from a video playing quietly on a TV that no one's watching. But Professor Williams says the day is an effective recruiting tool nonetheless.
Let's face it, a young man who is just, you know, in the throes of adolescence and still unsure about himself and his body is changing, and to have some Navy SEAL tell him, hey, you could be one of us, this is powerful stuff. And this is exactly the kind of person that they want to recruit. But really, if we're going to have a military, if we're either going to have a draft or we're going to try to convince people to join it, it is not an all-volunteer force. It's an all-recruited force.
And up now. Go. Pull, man. You got it. A little more. There you go, man. You got it.
Back at the Trident Challenge, another Depper named Joe Bennett is providing much of the motivation for the pull-up portion of the test. Most of today's athletes are somewhere in their late teens and early 20s, and almost exclusively male. But Joe has spent most of the day offering encouragement to 52-year-old Debbie Duffy. While the guys showed up in dark-colored, skin-tight swimming trunks, Debbie arrived in a pink-flowered bathing suit, beneath which you could see the scar from a heart valve replacement 10 years ago. Debbie came today to test out her fitness level, but despite Joe's best motivational efforts, she wasn't able to do a single pull-up. She's not shy about vocalizing her disappointment.
I hate him. I couldn't try any harder.
Was that worse than the swimming?
Much worse. Worse than push-ups. I like push-ups in comparison.
So what do you think so far? All you have left is the run? That's all you have
to do? I hate running. Last time I ran was into my husband's arms, and he's been dead a year and a half, so I hate running.
On your mark. Get set. Go.
Though she's tired, Debbie joins the rest of her group for 12 laps around the track. Petty Officer Gonzalez looks on. He's been working with Deppers who are getting ready for Bud's training. And although he's clear on the fact that the day is not about recruiting, he can't help but notice a few candidates for his program.
I did see a couple, and I did see at least a little boy who's 8 years old. The guy was smoking. You know what I mean? I'm sure when he's a senior, he goes, you know what? I love the way that was. I love that physical challenge. I love that mental challenge. I want that challenge. I need to go to the Navy recruiting office. I need to sign up.
The Navy might get a shot at 16-year-old John O'Shea a little sooner. He finishes the mile-and-a-half run in 8:04, and he barely looks like he's broken a sweat. As he comes off the track, one of the Deppers asks him for his other scores.
Sit-ups I had 105.
Good.
And push-ups I had 76.
You want a job?
What?
Most of John's scores surpass what the Navy calls the competitive standards, or the scores recommended for success at Bud's training. John says he didn't come here to find out about joining the military. He just wanted to have fun and get a good workout. But after a day of teamwork and booyahs, he's considering it.
They haven't put pressure on anyone, but it makes you want to go in, because it looks like fun and pushing yourself to the limit, and that's what I like to do, so it sounds pretty cool.
Even though they go off to war?
That's the only part I don't like. I don't like the shooting people and getting shot at. That's the only reason why I wouldn't do it. But sounds cool.
At the end of the day, John will leave with a free T-shirt and a copy of a DVD called Defending Freedom in the 21st Century. For their end of the deal, the Navy requires quite a bit of information from John. Not only his name, age, and contact information, but also how he scored on 5 different physical tests entered into a computer by civilians in white T-shirts. Joe Galzetti with Campbell Ewald, an ad agency hired by Navy Recruiting, says there's nothing to read into that.
That's their scores. All that information is being put into the computer, tabulating, keeping track of that, and there are awards associated with all that. So it's purely just to give them a sense of how they did.
So the recruiters aren't going to be looking at the scores from the 16-year-old kid and say, I want to call him.
No. No.
But as our interview concludes, Galzetti looks like he has something else he wants to say.
Well, no, it's about the recruitment thing, and there is information that's happening, and there is a chance that, yes, somebody will get a phone call. If people want to provide us their information, which they do, they're going to get a phone call from the local recruiter.
Let's go, let's go, good job!
Depper Joe Bennett has finished his run. At 10:10, it's his personal best. In the past 2 months, Joe says he's improved his scores on every portion of the PST. But he's not likely to boast about the improvements he's made or about how much help he's given today to people like Debbie Duffy.
Oh, God, no. Best motivators are actually over there. They're actually the ones who really got me into this. When I was first starting off, they pushed me past my limits. I'm glad I've done my job, and I think I have a lap to go run with her, though.
Oh, okay.
I'll go with her last lap.
With that, Joe cuts our interview short and joins Debbie on the track. She's little more than halfway through her run, and every time they come around for another lap, Joe jogs off the track and grabs a few more people to join in. Joe says the Navy SEALs don't leave anyone behind.
If Navy, we will carry you over there. We have you. You are our team. We will not leave you behind.
Before long, almost the entire group is back on the track. Joe lets Debbie slow to a walk on the corners and then starts her running again on the straightaways. And then, in true military fashion, there's the singing.
Superman is the man of steel.
Superman is the man of steel.
The cadence tells a tale of romance. Superman meets a Navy SEAL. Superman is impressed. Lois Lane dumps Superman and starts dating the SEAL. Debbie is thrilled.
I can't, I want to be Lois.
I don't want to be no Green Beret.
I don't want to be no Green Beret.
They only beat me once a day.
As the group rounds the final corner, Debbie breaks into a sprint and crosses the finish line first, with her arms raised high. As she catches her breath, she can't say enough nice things about Joe and the other guys who helped her make her way around the track.
Well, actually, these are the same ages that get on a plane and go to Iraq, so it shouldn't surprise us, but it does. I always looked up to Navy SEALs. I always have, and all the people in the military. I always have. Even more so now that they would do this for a 52-year-old broad, you know.
Debbie talks about going back to her trainer at the gym to get some new workouts. And she laughs about how much her friend Martha would have enjoyed, quote, the gorgeous 20-year-olds bearing their tattoos. The Navy hasn't yet decided whether they'll hold another Trident challenge. If they do, rest assured, Debbie Duffy will be there. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Good job, good job. 456, 457. Here you go, keep moving, keep moving.
You're listening to Only a Game. At year's end, it's natural enough for any sports fan to wish for winning teams, or at least for new seasons unencumbered by some of the dross that has characterized sports in 2007. Would it be too much to hope that in 2008 no pro athlete would be indicted for his participation in dogfighting? What about drugs? Might one dare to hope that in 2008 the most exceptional athletes among us might decide to be so satisfied with their exceptional performances that they wouldn't chemically enhance same? And while they're at it, what if even the most addle-pated among them reached the conclusion that it's not a good idea to be standing around armed in a strip club at 2:30 in the morning, even if all you're doing is standing around and have no intention of firing your gun with malicious intent? Wouldn't that be a good thing? Perhaps the people who entertain fantasies like these feel that if they had the potential, the work ethic, and the opportunity to develop into star athletes, they'd be so happy and grateful that they'd never risk the benefits of their good fortune by engaging in criminal and idiotic behavior. And it's probably safe to conclude that some number of great athletes feel just this way, just as some wealthy business people feel so fortunate that they'd never put their reputations in jeopardy by cooking the company books, so they can build even more houses and buy bigger boats. But some great athletes are also inclined to cheat and cut corners, just like some number of building contractors. Some teachers pretend to lose their students' papers so they won't have to read them. We are a flawed lot, no matter our profession. So as we move toward a new year, maybe all we can reasonably hope is that the elation and the sense of transcendence we get from our games and the best moments they provide will outweigh the disappointment that comes with the discovery that someone we've enjoyed watching has broken the law, or lots of laws. It may seem a humble expectation, but in a sports landscape given over to excess, where we've encouraged young athletes to feel entitled and invulnerable, perhaps ongoing delight in the beauty of the games, despite the trespasses of those performing in them, is the most reasonable New Year's wish a spectator can have. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Patience is a crucial quality for a fisherman. Timothy Hamilton of Glen Burnie, Maryland, lacked patience enough to wait until he could buy the $700 fishing reel he coveted, and so he walked into a fishing supplies store and slipped the reel into his pants. When a suspicious employee of the store alerted the police, Mr. Hamilton decided to lock himself in the bathroom, a move that suggests patience isn't the only positive quality he lacks. Having retrieved the fishing reel, the officer who arrested Mr. Hamilton proceeded to the suspect's car, where he found the drug paraphernalia for which he hadn't even been fishing.
I'm juiced up and feeling good. Well, just down the road, there's a place called Bubba's. Man, he's really got the good. And the sign said beer, bait, and ammo, yeah.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. Dented fenders and quarter panels equal post-marital bliss. But first, the 30th annual Guiding Eyes for the Blind Golf Classic took place last June, and Bill Littlefield was there. Hey, wait, that would be me. And yes, I had the story, and it went like this. On Sunday, under blue skies cooled by intermittent breezes, Johnny Cassolo, a wiry, athletic-looking gentleman who used to sell Hondas, prepares to drive a golf ball off the first tee of the Mount Kisco Country Club in Westchester County, New York. The gallery's encouragement notwithstanding, Johnny Cassolo's tee shot would not be all that impressive, maybe 130 yards out, bouncing into the right rough, except that Johnny Cassolo not only can't see where the ball has gone, he couldn't see it sitting on the tee in front of him before he hit it. Cassolo is one of the 15 golfers competing in the 30th annual Guiding Eyes for the Blind Golf Classic. After Johnny's drive, his coach, Chris Clark, leads him back to their golf cart, where Johnny's guide dog, a black lab named Hallie, waits patiently.
Yeah, she's a great one.
Does she help you out there on the course?
No.
Of course he's going to say that, right?
The dog's a bigger help than the coaches, for sure.
And this is from the coach?
Absolutely.
Okay.
See, when nobody's looking, I have him pick up the ball and drop it in the hole.
In fact, Hallie was just along for the ride. On the golf course, a blind golfer's coach does the guiding. The coach lines the golfer up behind the ball, positions the club head, warns of the water to the left or the sand trap to the right, estimates the distance to the pin, and then stands back and says clear, so the golfer knows it's okay for him to swing. Except that at the guiding eyes for the Blind Golf Classic, the golfer isn't always him. Dr. Angela O'Rourke, a retired Army colonel with several blind golf titles to her credit, was among the competitors in Mount Kisco on Sunday, and her dog, Faith, really is a help out on the golf course.
Well, yes, she is, because she's actually a dual dog. Not only is she a guide dog, but she's a seizure dog. So when I have seizures out on the golf course, it helps me clear out of the fog much faster.
How does that work exactly?
Well, you know, I can't explain it other than, like, when I have seizures, it's like the gears aren't completely working correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of hitting each other instead of into the grooves. And when I love on the dog, it's like a shell of protection comes over me.
It's calming.
It's very calming. Where if a human touches me, the fright or the scaredness increases. Mm. But, you know, I just curl the dog. The dog is trained to where if I fall over, she's to come and lay over by me. Or if I call her, she'll come and lay right next to me, and I curl up and cuddle with her. And it just takes that fog out. You know, and it's awesome.
Angela O'Rourke, Johnny Cassolo, and the rest of the blind golfers competing have all been hitting golf balls they can't see for long enough so that they no longer regard that achievement as awesome. In fact, they take in stride achievements that make playing golf in the dark seem simple. Consider, for example, Bill McMahon, who lost his sight to diabetes more than 20 years ago. I asked him how his health was these days.
It's not good. I had a very serious fall in October 2004. And, you know, my back is still affected by it. I broke some vertebrae. I broke 8 bones in my wrist. I broke my humerus bone and damaged my rotator cuff on my left side.
And you're still playing golf. I'm impressed. You
know, I said to the doctor my first day in the hospital, and he told me that I may never walk again. And I, you know, I kind of looked where he was talking from, and I said, "You don't know me. I'm not only going to walk, but I'm going to swing a club again." And I think he thought I was nuts, but I did it.
Which is not to say every shot Bill McMahon hits finds its mark. That's a characteristic he shares with, among others, Dick Pomo, who traveled with his wife and coach Sharon from Green Valley, Arizona for Sunday's tournament. On the par 3 eighth hole, Pomo's drive was not all he'd have liked it to be.
Oh, off to the right. Off to the right. How did that happen? Well, we'll have to go down and see where you're at. Well, let's go down and see where you're at, my guy.
Waiting his turn at the tee while Dick Pomo went in search of his drive were Johnny Cassolo and his coach Chris Clark. Coach Clark, with help from Johnny, explained to me that even if Pomo's drive was lost in the woods, it wouldn't be a disaster. The scoring system in this tournament rewards a good hole without penalizing a bad one.
If you make a triple bogey, which is 3 over par, you get 1 point. A double bogey is 2 over par, you get 2 points. A bogey is 1 over, you get 3 points. And then they make a par, 5 points. So you actually, and then a birdie is 8 points. And what that does is it kind of promotes being a little bit more aggressive.
And the other thing, you don't get discouraged. Because, you know, if you're playing in a regular score, you know, you get a hole, you shoot a 10 or a 12 or a 13, which it happens, you know. Here, you pick up, you go home, you know, that's it, you go to the next hole. So it doesn't work on your psyche, you know.
I left the course at about 6:30, by which time only 2 twosomes had holed out. One of them included the eventual winner, 74-year-old Pat Brown of New Orleans, whom I met as his son and coach, Pat Brown III, led the victor off the 18th green once he had concluded his round by draining a 10-foot putt. As Pat Brown III took his dad's arm and helped him to their cart, I complimented Mr. Brown Sr. on the sense of drama he demonstrated with that final putt. He smiled and said he had a great coach. Pat Brown lost his sight when a car swerved into the vehicle in which he was a passenger over 40 years ago. On Sunday, he finished with 37 points, meaning that he'd averaged about 2 over par per hole. Brown has won this tournament 17 times, though he says he's not counting.
No, sir. I'd like to get a number and add one after today, but I don't know what the starting number is. I mean, I got an idea, but let's just see what happens today. What's past is gone, you know.
And what was present on that golf course in the sunshine was almost entirely glorious. Almost, because even on the best of days, golf can be hard work. Sheila Drummond, who lost her sight to diabetes 26 years ago, knows that. When she and her husband and coach Keith, who pride themselves on playing quickly enough so that they're often held up by sighted players, finished their round, Sheila was realistic rather than Pollyannic.
We didn't play great, but, you know, golf is a tough game. It's tough for sighted people. It's even more difficult for blind people and competition. I get nervous. I get scared. You know, I'm not a cool, calm, collected person. Need to say any more?
Perhaps she doesn't, but I will. Sheila Drummond was one of the few competitors who'd never played golf before she lost her sight. She had to learn everything without seeing anything. When she started playing, her husband was skeptical.
You got me going, yeah. We tried to bowl one time together. That didn't work out so well. And she hasn't bowled with me since. And then she wanted to take golf up, and after she started, she says, you know, you ought to do this. I said, oh, no, you don't. If you're doing it in 2 years, I'll give it a shot. And here I am.
And I hope you're enjoying it sometimes.
Some days we enjoy it, some days we don't, and some days we don't even like each other.
In that respect, at least, blind golf is perhaps no different from golf played by a husband and wife who can both see, except that the blind golf played last weekend wasn't just for fun. The 30th annual Guiding Eyes for the Blind Classic raised a lot of money for the organization that has provided Angela O'Rourke with Faith, Johnny Casola with Hallie, and a great many other blind people around the world with the guide dogs who've enriched their lives.
Good looking shot. Good looking shot. You're on the front. Okay, Mike, run the front.
Demolition derbies have been around for as long as many racetracks and some county fairs have. This highly interactive event in which cars collide until only one is left moving has been a devastating diversion. But as Ron Schachter reported last summer from Rockford, Illinois, one racetrack has given a new twist to the standard contest of twisted metal.
Amanda and Alan Melker look over a group of freshly painted vehicles on a grassy lot next to Rockford Speedway. On this summer Saturday night, they seem like any other married couple searching for a goodbye on a used car.
Take that one on you.
Imperial? Yeah. At least they have seat belts. I feel a little safer.
But the cars here are very used, just imported from the local junkyard, in fact. And the Melkers are no longer married. They'll need those seat belts in 2 hours when they square off against each other and six additional ex-couples in the second annual Divorcee Demolition Derby. Alan signed up a few weeks ago, and he can count the ways he loves this contest.
Safe way to put a dent in the side of your ex-wife's car. Legally. I want that trophy. Maybe we'll get to keep the cars, too, after we're done.
Trouble is, he didn't mention his plans to Amanda until this afternoon.
He didn't tell me till a couple hours ago. I need you to do something for me. Well, what do you need? Go to the races with me tonight. Okay, and oh, by the way, we're in a demo derby.
Amanda says that kind of communication was par for the course during their 3-year marriage. So she found a last-minute babysitter, told her young daughter that mommy and daddy were going to bump into each other with cars, but just for fun, and headed to the racetrack. Rockford Speedway is one of about 100 grassroots tracks around the country that serve as minor league venues of NASCAR racing. But the Speedway has also earned a reputation for more innovative events, such as its Figure 8 Trailer Race of Destruction. Earlier this season, teams of stock cars pushed around a 4-foot-wide black-and-white metal soccer ball. General Manager Greg McKern says that tonight's demo derby was an idea whose time had come.
There's all these divorced people. I mean, it's sad to say in America, but there are a lot of divorced people out there. So we decided we're going to try a Divorcee Demo Derby. Last year we did it on a Wednesday night, which is kind of our R&D night, to test out different ideas. And the crowd response was huge to it. It was our biggest Wednesday night crowd. So this year we put it on a Saturday night, and brought it into the prime time, if you will.
Speedway owner David Deary adds that he's had to make some extra accommodations for this event.
The Demolition Derby is probably one of the fiercest events in motorsports. If you'd ever watched the Demo Derby and you could concentrate on the drivers, you'll see the force and the G-forces that they take in these hits. So what we need to convey to these participants tonight is, you know, we're gonna stretch out prior to the event. We're going to use our necks and get real loose the best we can. And since these people are mostly rookies, we're going to pad their cars, some of the doors, some of the areas that their limbs will fly, actually, when they get hit.
Across town, Dr. Lisa Breisch has worked the past 10 years as a marriage counselor. She describes her own concerns about the Divorcee Derby.
Some couples may have a lot of unresolved issues from the marriage, and it could be rather tricky. And if they are very angry at each other or are not in a healthy place, things could kind of get dangerous, actually, because you're stirring up old unresolved feelings. Or it could be actually fun and kind of a bonding experience, depending on the couple.
The drivers here seem to fit the latter category. They exchange quips and pleasantries while spray painting decorations on their chosen cars, which have been colored blue for boys and pink for girls. The numbers on the side doors range from 1 to 5, with a 3.2 and 3.5 thrown in, representing the years the competitors stayed hitched. Amanda Melker says she's even received some ex-husbandly advice from Alan.
He said, go in reverse. That's what he told me. Just go in reverse and save your front end. That was his words of wisdom to me.
One rival, two cars down, plans on taking a more direct approach and taking no prisoners.
Oh, just floor it and go. Get them as hard as I can.
Forward or backward?
Both.
The banter stops and the faces get sober when Deary gives a literal crash course in what's down the road.
There's two parts of your body that'll get hurt in this event. Your neck and your hands. So when you're backing up or when you're going to hit somebody, get your hands off the wheel. Because if your wheel hits the car or another wall or whatever, the wheel will spin. Don't put your thumbs inside. Keep them on the outside. Never grab the wheel. Never grab the wheel.
After the lesson, the ex-couples don their helmets and start their engines.
For the 3.2 years, it was Jim and Sarah Powers. She's bossy and he's lazy. Obviously, that one wasn't going to work. Then for a whole 3 years, Alvin and Amanda Melker. Well, he was a Bear fan. She was a Packer fan.
The drivers line up along the finish line with the rear ends of their cars directly across from those of their ex-spouses. Just as they shared the first dance at their weddings, they'll get the first crack at each other here. After that, it's a free-for-all. Almost 2,000 fans watch the collisions of pink and blue. After a slow start, the drivers become more aggressive, and the contest turns into a 15-minute mechanical melee. The frequent contact, dragging bumpers, and spinning wheels become metaphors for marriages gone awry as the combatants hurtle backwards and personally deliver the messages they've scrawled on their fenders. Love, hate, call 911, have a nice day. Some ex-wives have emblazoned large dollar signs on their hoods, reminders of alimony past due. But it soon becomes clear that this is not just a battle of the exes, but a battle of the sexes.
How many of you think the women are going to win? How many of you want to see the men pulled off this year?
When the remaining two blue cars make a head-on charge into each other, the field is left to the women for the second year in a row. Amanda Bielefleet in car number 5 is among that trio. Bielefleet races the minor league NASCAR circuit here on Wednesday nights, but she says she's found a new love.
I love totaling cars.
Have you ever had a collision before in your driving days?
Nope, never.
No?
And come out here now, I like to hit cars.
Marriage counselor Lisa Breisch suggests that the Demo Derby would be well served if a psychologist were present, along with the tow truck drivers and EMTs.
I think afterwards that people should do some things about how this felt. How was this experience for them before, during, and after? And how has this affected their relationship with their ex afterwards?
Bryce may soon get her wish. She's thinking of entering next year's Divorcee Demo Derby with her own ex. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Rockford, Illinois. She can't take another day of me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to peruse our panoply of podcasts, view our many photo galleries, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Divorcee Derby driver. All right. Let's let bygones be bygones. Okay, then. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. Happy New Year, and I'll see you next week. She can't take another day of me.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.